Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. I am glad to have you here. Bunch of new stuff on the service today. We have Agave, which is a film about making tequila in Mexico. It is actually fantastic. You need to watch it. We have a bunch of educational stuff. We have some blind tasting sessions coming. We have released our trailer, which shows all of the new things coming to SOM TV, and we have dropped our prices. It is $49.99 for a year. $49.99 for a year of SOM TV. It hurts me to even say that. We're working so hard, you guys. You can leave tips if you want to pay more. And it is $5.99 a month. So that'll translate into whatever currency you use in your home country. But we've dropped the prices. Our trailer's out. We have several more feature films, all sorts of series coming, and lots of very interesting personalities. On today's show, I have a good friend of mine named Jonah Beer. Jonah, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good. Jonah works at Frog's Leap Winery in Napa, which is, well, a really, really good winery. You should go visit. You should know the history, all of these things. And we'll talk more about that. But Jonah is also a couple things. One, he's one of the funniest oddballs I've ever met in Napa. And he is known by everybody up here. We have a lot of friends in common, including like the Lynn Proctor and members of the cast of our films. But you have an insane, wild story of how you got into the wine world. And I think, first I should if nobody knows who you are, we should explain, what do you do in Napa, and why do so many people know who you are up here?
Yeah, well, why do people know who I am up here is a good question. Because no one knows who I am anywhere else. Yeah, exactly. The Napa to me, and kind of how I got here is they're kind of all intertwined together, right? And I think that, I have this, and it's been 25 years, almost 25 years that I've been living now here in Napa Valley. And I came here very purposefully, very driven to get here. So I still have this kind of like childlike wonder and love of the Napa Valley, right? It's like that one great love of your life that you never fall out of love with.
And aren't you supposed to get really jaded about Napa Valley?
You're supposed to, and I think that shows that there's either something wrong with me or something right with Napa. Yeah, and I guess that because I've been here a long time and I've always felt like the underdog, and even with that, I've always kind of felt like the outsider. I'm constantly trying to welcome other people, boost people up, help people make connections, introduce anybody to anyone else that just might be able to do something for each other without really having anything in it for me. And it's led me to meeting a tremendous number of great people who I can now call friends and colleagues and sometimes co-workers.
So currently you work as the director of...
It's a vice president of a whole bunch of words that follow that, and general manager at Frog's Leap. Yeah, so that's been 17 years in 2 weeks. Because I know this is coming up like right away. This is going to be posted. I can say that. In 2 weeks, it'll be my 17-year workiversary at Frog's Leap.
Well, the business of wine, the concept of like we actually have to sell shit.
Yes, we do.
Is not a common factor, especially like within my films. It's mostly like, hey, look at what happened in World War II. And look at this sommelier who's trying to do something pretentious. Like,
yes, that seems to be a theme of most your films.
Yes. But when it comes
to wine...
Look
at this shit that never really happens.
Yeah. Oh, my God, I know. I know. I'm a fraud.
No, yeah. You're fine. The others are... No, I'm kidding. Looking at you, D-Lynn.
Yeah, poor D-Lynn. So when you look at the actual wine business, people forget it is a business, and you are on the side of...
Yeah.
Making sure wine sells.
Yeah.
And there are many more like you up here in Napa and all over France and all over the world.
Yep.
And normally your stories aren't as sexy.
No, it's not. It's usually not nearly as sexy as like the toiling winemaker who is racking his wine by candlelight in the caves and, also mostly bullshit. I love that. You see bags of sugar in the cellars of like the great cellars of Beaune, and you're like, well, why do you guys have so much sugar? And they're like, we drink a lot of coffee. Fuck off, you're chapelizing, you son of a... So, the rule of viticulture and enology, winemaking and being a vintner is global, and most of it is you gotta bullshit a lot, often, and never crack. I had lunch just yesterday.
See, you sound like you're falling perfectly in with the jaded...
No, but that's what's the best part is that those are the things that you kind of have to do to keep the dream alive, not only for your customer, but also for yourself. Because this is a hard business. And Highway 29 is littered with the dead bodies of billionaire wineries that have really sprung up, flamed out, and they've all, you know, I never really wanted to own a winery anyway. I'm just going to move back to my island, you know? And it's like, good for you. Because right. If you're not in this because there's something deep in your soul that's driving, and I'm sure it's the same with film, right? You don't make... Everyone sees the red carpet and the step and repeat with like logos on it, and everyone's taking pictures, but that's not filmmaking, and that's probably not what drives you to do it. You've got to be in love with the process.
I'm four steps ahead of the adult film industry still. I just want to stay in front of it. I want to stay out of that business. It's not kind, and I don't want to go back.
It is not kind. And listen, I loved you in your early work, especially with that long handlebar mustache that you were
good.
Rocking.
It was good.
It was really good. I'm here to fix the copier.
Yeah. Oh, you saw that.
I did see that one. Yeah.
That's a good one.
And I knew you were going to break the paper tray. I was like, there's no way D-Rox can stand up to the abuse he's putting in.
I knew
right
this
now.
Podcast was going to be a shit show, Joe. This is just going to be a chaos shit show. You know what's cool about this? At this point in these podcasts, only my mom's listening. Doesn't matter.
And she's only doing it because she's nervous of what we're going to say next.
Yeah. She's also nervous I'm getting back into the adult industry.
Yes, she
wants to make sure, keep tabs on me. So, okay.
So you got to be in love with the process is what I was getting at. And so it's not about being jaded or fake or phony. What it is you have to learn to love all the steps that go through it. And the one that no one thinks they're going to want to do or be a part of, because I moved out here to be a winemaker too.
We're going to get to your story.
That was the life goal. But what I discovered was then that there was actually a lot more joy to be found for me in opening bottles and sharing them with people, sharing them with sommeliers around the country, around the world, wine shop owners and workers and people at dinners and things, because you watched the joy that bottle of wine could give them. And I realized that's where I felt like the real true connection between people, wine, and story. It was happening out in the world.
This, what you're saying right now, is something that a lot of people say, and almost to the point where it becomes a cliche, but it is a fact.
Yes.
It truly is. It's not, you know, there's a little bit of fun with a tiny bit of alcohol that comes with wine, but there's also, like, that loosens you up, but there's also really is a... There is a dish, but once you add wine to it, it opens that up. And once you add food and wine to people, it opens them up. And it's really a true story. That is absolutely, and anybody who's listening to this podcast for sure, my mother probably only.
Yes, she's great.
Understands that wine is a gateway to incredible things, especially friendship and all these other things.
Absolutely. Social lubrication that wine brings to the occasion is a real thing.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
It really is. Okay, so before... And I should tease a little bit. Your story is, I think, one of the, in my years of hearing people getting into the wine business and the adversity they face to get into it, I will just tease that you come from a very strict Mennonite family, and now you are whatever the hell you've become in Napa Valley.
Right.
And we're going to tell that story because it's fantastic. But I want to talk about Frog's Leap for a second.
Yeah, sure.
When I was a server in Ohio,
okay,
I worked at a place called Gamekeeper's Lodge.
Oh, I know that place.
One of the better restaurants in Cleveland, and they sold quite a bit of Frog's Leap. And it was like, I didn't know anything about wine. And as a server, I really attached myself to this wine. A, it was, had some, you know, it was cost a bit.
Yep.
But B, it had the frog jumping on the front of the label.
And I thought the cork says ribbit. It's like, that's just enough to give you, to make it a great sell.
Yeah. Well, the weird thing is it was very easy for me to latch on and say, oh, you guys have to try this Sauvignon Blanc from Frog's Leap. Oh, you guys have to try this Cabernet from Frog's Leap. And that was one of my entry point wines into wine, even as a young, you know, man in Cleveland. And but so when you, let's talk about Frog's Leap just for a second.
Because
I want to know how you stay interested in the same wines for 17 years. Because it's not like Frog's Leap is all of a sudden going, let's make... Marsan, or something like that.
We don't have a Certico out in the vineyard right now that we're experimenting with.
Right. You make Cabernet and you make Sauv Blanc.
Yeah.
And you make, I'm assuming...
Zin, Merlot, Chardonnay, five wines, same five wines for almost 40 years.
Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about Frog's Leap for a moment.
Yeah.
Why is that such an important winery? And why does it matter to you? And how do you stay interested in it to sell it for 17 years.
Yeah, and I think it's the same reason I wanted to work there. It's the same reason I wrote a letter to John Williams, the owner, sitting on a beach in Grenada with my wife on our honeymoon, like an 8-page letter, handwritten, you know, on paper, for the younger listeners, mail used to not be electronic. It used to just go through this thing called the post office. And I wrote him an 8-page letter just kind of outlining why, what I thought was so innovative, interesting, smart, forward-thinking about what he had been doing at Frog's Leap, and then why I wanted to be a part of it and what I thought I could bring to the table.
And what were those innovative things? What were those innovative things? First of all, an 8-page letter, you should have filed a restraining order against
him. No, I think he did. Yeah, I got a call from the sheriff. I think he still actually has the letter to he's in a drawer somewhere. It's like Exhibit A if he's ever murdered.
Right.
I know Jonah did it. It was the first pitch came around the idea that he had built a culture there at Frog's Leap that was unlike where I'd come from. So I was working at Stag's Leap Wine Cellars, which is where I first landed, and had been there for just about 6 years. And, you know, that was kind of this very kind of rigid place. And you know, the owner, Warren Winyarski, was kind of a... he was a professor at, you know, St. John's College in Santa Fe, and the kind of guy that wore an ascot but did it, you know, not ironically. You know, he was that guy.
And then for people listening, he is the guy who made the Stag's Leap wine that won the Judgment of Paris. Not known as a chill dude.
Not known as a chill dude at all. The kind of guy whose children had to like dress up in pilgrim outfits for like Thanksgiving. You know,
but
like,
a genius.
A mad genius.
Yes.
A mad genius. And also a risk taker in his own way.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a story for another time about the day he met Nathan Fay. And like, you know.
You and I are terrible to get together. It's the most tangential.
Yeah.
Nonsense, insanity.
Right.
Okay. So
to John Williams at Frog's Leap, who had built a culture there that was kind of, I gotta hate the word inclusive, but it was like everyone was involved. He turned it into a joyful place to work. Like, it was, people loved going to work there, and people that worked with him and for him just adored kind of this idea that he had started, which was, we're going to do things differently. You know, people ask me why Frog's Leap, and I say that because there's something in the ethos of both John as a person and now the company, the brand, and the culture, that we're there to challenge conventional thinking in pursuit of fine wine. Like, there's no taboos there. If you want to challenge an assumption because you think you can produce a wine, grow better grapes that are more deeply connected to the earth or more reflective of the terroir, or a winemaking approach that's going to yield something that's more varietally correct or more based in tradition, then you can pitch almost anything and it can get an idea there.
Within the window of we make these five wines.
Within the window of we make these five wines, and within the window of how we define success and how we define, you know, kind of the glory of wine, and that is that it needs to reflect terroir. It should be balanced. It has to offer a sense of elegance, right?
He is this very interesting Pied Piper. I mean, I know when I met DeLynn Proctor, he's in all three of my films so far. I think he's in the fourth Saw movie coming out too, where he could not stop talking about Frog's Leap and John and all this stuff. And as far as like a major inspiration for why he got into wine.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating. Anyone you meet who has any connection has the exact same attitude about that man and about that place.
And about what we've done. You know, you look at like, it's dry farmed, right? And it sounds, you know, revolutionary today. Like, you know, most youngsters are like, well, you can't grow grapes in Napa without irrigation. And John was the first to, you know, he was a UC Davis grad. He did all the shit wrong. And, you know, he was herbicides and pesticides and a company called Crop Care to tell him how much, you know, manganese he needed to add in and how much the NPK was going to, you know, application per, you know, acre needed to be. And he went at it just like a regular petrochemical farmer with, you know, water and herbicide and fertilizers, and quickly started to go, he's watching the vineyard that he just bought die in front of him, you know, and get a nematode or leaf roll virus or red leaf virus. And then it was, something's got to be, like, this doesn't feel right and this can't be right. So when he met a guy up in from Mendocino, recommended to him through a guy in Mendocino named Paul Dolan, and he met a guy named Amigo Bob, who's like the organic consultant to the Napa Valley and most of Northern, helped start California's Certified Organic Farmers, the CCOF, the certifying body of organic farming in California. Here's this guy with dreadlocks down to his ass and tie-dyed shirt and hemp shorts and homemade leather sandals. And, you know, everyone looks at him, he just thinks about, oh, I bet that guy smokes his cover crop, ha ha. You know, and everyone just thought he was this hippie farmer. And the guy knew more about creating mycorrhizal fungi and returning microbial life to the soil and developing the mycelium network so that grapevines would be deeply connected to a larger world and they would be fed with all the food and water that they needed. And And the revolutionary thought that he planted in John's brain in 1985 was, if you do this right, it, being an organic grower and dry farmer won't be about not using chemicals in water, it'll be about not needing chemicals in water. So you'll never think again, oh shit, this would be so much easier if I could turn on the garden hose, or if I could add Roundup, or if I could add Miracle-Gro. And that was this fundamental shift in thinking that pushed John through the door, and he became the pioneer. He was the guy that went through and became the first certified organic grape grower in Northern California. It's completely dry farmed right now on 250 acres scattered around the valley on all different soil types, and leading this for almost 35 years, where everyone would say, you're nuts, it can't happen, you'll never get a full crop, your vines will die, they won't live long, your children will be ostracized, you know, it was all of those things. And, you know, he stuck with it because he saw that all of these things would make for better wines, better in the way that we define better, which is not the way that maybe others do, right? If getting $1,000 a bottle and 400 points Parker is your goal, this isn't necessarily going to help with that.
It might. Does Parker go up to 400 points?
I think he does now. I'm pretty sure that he's got to expand. Yeah. You know,
he's got competition now, huh?
Well, he's got, you know, the currency's been devalued.
I think Parker is sitting in his house in Maryland having a scotch right now, not thinking twice about any of this crap anymore.
I'm sure he's not. Yeah. I'm sure he's not, and that's okay. And it wasn't his fault. It was the people who stopped doing anything for a reason other than his accolades, who abandoned maybe principles that they once had because...
So this is how you stay interested.
This is how I stay interested.
Is that there is this really nice fundamental slab under the house.
Yes.
Of free thinking and responsibility to the environment, all those things.
Yes, and that we have to stay innovative. Like we're this year for the first time, we've got alternating rows in a couple of our vineyards where we're no longer tilling the soil. Typically, when you dry farm in a hot climate like this, you till the soil during the summer to break up the topsoil to release basically trapped moisture from the topsoil so that it causes a wicking action or more moisture from deeper in the soil tries to make its way to evaporate, because the moisture trapped in the soil is constantly trying to get out, either through evaporation or through the plant itself.
And that helps drive the roots deeper? Or?
It helps to actually bring moisture as moisture dries and retreats in the summertime, and it just starts to get drier and warmer, deeper and deeper and deeper, the roots of the vine will keep chasing that until they fundamentally can't anymore. But if you go through and you rake the soil at the top, you can get deep-seated moisture below the roots to make their way to the bottom of the roots. So you can almost get, you know, one day of cultivation is worth 4 days of irrigation. That was what the old timers would tell you. But we decided we needed to push further. A woman named Mimi Castile up in Oregon is now someone that I'm watching and listening to and desperately want to be best friends with, because I think she's leading the charge right now in understanding the needs of things like the mycelium network, or what we call the food web, the underground mycorrhizal fungi that now connect all living plants. We didn't understand the damage we were doing to that through all of our tilling. So now we're using a new system of crimping, where we're rolling the cover crop instead of plowing it. And we're going to allow for a little more water stress on the vines themselves. And it's a constant need to innovate. And that constant itch is always present at Frog Sleep. And it feels like, because a lot of people look at it and go, oh, 40 years of, you know, I was talking with Curtis Mann, who did such a great job on your blind tasting series. If you haven't seen the one with Ted Henry and Curtis Mann, as soon as this podcast is done, you need to click
turn
over
on,
and
turn
watch
on
that.
Blind tasting sessions.
Yeah, and it's so great. And watching Curtis go through those wines is awesome. But we were talking business the other day. He's an MW and the buyer for Raley's. And I was talking about a new store they're opening called Raley's One, O-N-E, where it's all organic. You know, there's a whole list of banned ingredients that anything in the store can't have high fructose corn syrup. Nothing can have soy lecithin. Nothing can be, everything in the store. So you can just walk in the store and pull whatever you want. You don't have to read ingredient labels anymore. And I'm so impressed by how this Sacramento-based company that's family-owned is staying progressive and innovative, trying to change food shopping culture. So we were talking about this, and this is the same kind of ongoing need to innovate and be forward-thinking that he and I were sharing this kind of discussion about how we think it's important to be at a company that has that kind of an ethos to it, that you're not resting on your laurels. You're not just sitting back going, we know how to make Zin. been doing it for 40 fucking years. We know how to make Zen. No, we're experimenting with... Sorry, do you have to mark that because I said the F word?
No, you can all swear right. In this pod. We're over 21. We're drinking right now. We're okay. Yeah. My mom will be all right.
Yeah, okay, good. So those are the reasons that I stay intrigued, fascinated, encouraged, and why Frog Sleep is kind of, you know, weaves its way into your soul and kind of you have a hard time getting rid of it. Then,
yeah, you know? That's great. Yeah. I mean, you know, my last final thoughts on that kind of topic is just that wine is trendy and yeah. It must be tough to have all the things in a 5-wine basket. You know?
Yeah,
Sideways yeah. comes out and all of a sudden Merlot's not cool for a minute.
Yeah, that was shit show. We were making 14,000 cases of Merlot the day Sideways came out, and uh-huh. now we're at like 4,000 cases.
I mean, that is...
The power of that statement, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, we had also... we kind of like to think about things slightly differently. If you go back and taste those wines that were of that time, it was some of the most garbage wines that were being made. Merlot was being grown, made... It was being grown in all the places it shouldn't. It was being made like Cabernet with training wheels. There was nothing interesting about the mass of Merlot that was out there.
Yeah.
So they had, as a variety, we had dug the hole already for the grave. You know, it was not... It wasn't a fell swoop. It was just the one that pushed us in, you know.
That's interesting perspective. I never thought
of that. But now, think about what it's done. It's actually saved the variety from extinction. There's maybe only 8 or 9 of us left in Napa that are growing and making Merlot. And even Frog's, if we realized we were pushing the envelope of growing Merlot. And we had some in Carneros on, you know, 3 years out of 10 was great. 3 years out of 10 was not great. I mean, downright bad. Well, that's not a good enough batting average, but we were sticking with it because, you know, we had the marketplace for it. Once the marketplace went away and there was not that urge for Merlot to be everywhere, we refocused on where it could do very well, where we could make a Grand Cru style Merlot. And so ironically, the movie Sideways saved Merlot from extinction and is now ruining Pinot Noir. You know, because now there's just more garbage Pinot Noir grown in all the places it shouldn't be grown, made like Syrah, blended with Syrah. And, you know, it's ironic how quickly it turned. Sideways Part 2 will be all about how Pinot sucks, you know. And Paul Giamatti can come back and reprise his role.
I would, I'd like to see that happen. I like the first one. I'm in.
Hey, we actually made the second one at Frog Sleep. It's a Japanese version of the movie Sideways, shot with Japanese actors and characters, all in Japanese. And it's located here in Napa Valley. And the Virginia Madsen character in the original, her Japanese counterpart, works at Frog Sleep.
I know that this film exists.
Yeah,
I've never seen it.
Yeah, like, Japanese Sideways. It's great. And Frog Sleep is like the backdrop to it. And we did a screening of it all in Japanese at the winery. We had our whole wine club members there, people sitting around just reading subtitles and drinking wine. And it's super charming and very, it's a lot cleaner than like there's not the, you know, pounding anal scenes in the motel room.
I knew that's where you were going. Yeah. Oh my God. I knew you were going to say that.
My wife just clicked off of this podcast.
Oh, don't worry. Now. My mother just turned it off.
I want to hang out with your mom.
Jesus, I'm going to go to hell. Okay, all right.
Sorry.
We got to collect ourselves here.
I know.
Oh my God. Okay, so, Nadine, don't you cut that out. That's staying in the podcast. Nadine's our producer editor that I'm looking at right now. Very nervous about that last sentence there. Okay. So I want to talk about your story. Okay. You as a very educated and respected wine professional, like I said, on the sales side, but still, you know more than most people that I've ever met.
Thank you.
About the process of dirt and vines and grapes and
those are the technical terms.
Yes.
Dirt and vines and grapes.
That's correct.
I happen
to have made 3 films about wine servants to tell you that, okay?
Yeah, you have. You've elevated the profession to a lofty, lofty level.
Oh boy, which profession? Okay. All right, so you started, where are you from originally?
Indiana.
I want to urge everybody, this is just good stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
You're from Indiana, I'm from Ohio, I know this part of the world quite well.
Yeah, Milford, Indiana. If you took like a Fort Wayne, Indiana, which Northern Ohioans kind of sometimes know, like the Buckeyes might know where Fort Wayne is, right on the border between Indiana and Ohio. If you take a line, you draw from there to South Bend, Indiana, which is where Notre Dame is, that line crosses some of the most boring, desolate landscape in the history of the Americas, and right in the middle of it, like equidistant to those two points. So as far as you can get from both is Milford, Indiana. And Milford, Indiana is where I was born and raised into a very strict, as you mentioned, very religious household called the Apostolic Mennonites. We were a part of the original Anabaptist religion that came from Switzerland that gave rise to both, you know, the Amish faith and Mennonite and Apostolic. And so those are the three religions that came out of it. We were considered the progressives, you know, the Amish, of course, being the most strict, like, you know, horse and buggy only. The Mennonites, you could ride in a car if it was your neighbor's car. And then our church, which was you could have a car if you shared it with others and it was black. Like those were the, but still no TV, no radio.
How did you dress? You dressed?
We dressed, I guess like the polite, like dorks, you know? I mean, I got picked on obviously for the dress. We didn't have like the big headdresses that the Amish had. Like the women kept their heads covered, like my mom and aunts, they would all wear their heads covered with a veil. That would hang down on the sides. And then there was kind of a, that was your Sunday best veil that came down on the sides. And men would wear brown and charcoal was kind of really the two colors you could wear. A compliment, and Nadine's going to love this, a compliment you would give a woman in the church was, you look very plain today. Like if I wanted to compliment my aunt on, we went to church on Sunday, Saturday, and Wednesday. And if a Wednesday church was kind of like the, that was kind of the easygoing church service, you know, where it was only about 3 hours and there was one meal instead of two. And if you wanted to compliment your aunts, which I had, you know, my mom had three sisters, my dad had two, you would say, you look very plain today, Aunt Judy. You look very plain today. Plain was the goal. It's what you're shooting for.
Just my little jump in here is, first of all, you're wearing a scarf right
yes,
now that is
yes.
very beautiful.
Thank you.
You are not very plain today.
I'm not plain today. I have, in all cases, I have taken everything I was taught as a child and doing just the opposite.
You have one of the dirtiest mouths
yeah.
of anyone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You don't strike me, when I see you, I don't think, that guy's a Mennonite.
No. No. The alcohol, the perversion, you know, all the things. Quite literally, you know, there's this thing called Rumspringa, right?
Rumspringa. I'm familiar. Hold on, let me try to take a stab at this.
Right. Let's see.
This is when, and I'm familiar with it from an Amish standpoint.
Correct.
Is it a Mennonite thing too?
It really kind of was through all the churches. It's just each one kind of had their different version of how grand it was. For the Amish, it's the most out there.
And you, this is when you are about to truly enter the faith, and you go and you test yourself?
Yeah.
Is that right? You go out and you just like...
You don't really test yourself. It's kind of like sow your wild oats.
You
right?
go to like yeah. strip clubs and eat and...
Okay, but if you're in Milford, Indiana, and the nearest strip club is, you know, Chicago, like there's not that much to rebel against, right?
Right.
So, but what happens is the time when... So the whole faith is called Anabaptist, which is like adult baptism, which is like you have to make a choice to enter the church. Like you can't be put in as a kid. You have to make a choice.
Okay.
And so there has to be as a point when you're an adult of decision-making, you know, level, right?
And there's no alcohol in this religion, right?
No, gosh, no. There's no television, man. There's no radio. There's no baseball in this, like let alone, you know, like coffee was as far as it went, right? So no alcohol, nothing. And so there's a point though when they say like, you know, especially in the Amish church where they say, okay, look, if this is you now have a year to 2 years to go sow your wild oats. Now, most of what that means is, you know, you're going to wear blue jeans. You're going to go get a pair of what we would call dungarees, and you're going to wear your dungarees, and you're going to get a regular shirt, and you're going to put a radio in your buggy, or you're going to have a radio in your room at home, or you're going to try a beer, you know, you're going to smoke cigarettes and those sorts of things. And you're supposed to get it out of your system and then make a choice. If you choose to come back, boy, now you're in and you give up all that forever, right? So I've just said, like, I'm basically just on permanent Rumspringa. Like I just kind of stayed in the zeitgeist of let's experience all the world has to offer.
Let's smoke cigarettes and dungarees the rest of
yeah,
my life.
Yeah, you joke, but I was, I think, 11, my brother would have been 13, my sister, 8, and we were, my brother and I wanted to play t-ball, like, you know, just t-ball with just normal kids in Milford, Indiana that were playing baseball. And we wanted to play with them. And that was like, this was this no-no. And like the church was against it. And my dad, just kind of being a rebel, was like, you know what? We're going to go ahead and play anyway. My kids are going to play t-ball. And my kids are going to play baseball. And that led to the rift that ultimately led to
t-ball.
T-ball, baseball. Can you imagine today saying
I've seen Footloose.
Yeah.
And that's about as close as I understand what you're going through. I think that's quite different than reality, but that's as far as I know.
Right. I remember watching Footloose and thinking,
it's not even Anabaptist. It's just like, what?
Sinners. Like, what kind of town is this? Ugh, yellow cars? Please. Devil's Playground. That's what that is. So we find ourselves in this moment of getting kicked out of the church. And, you know, and it's like they go through this whole thing where, like, they kind of half shun you. Like, they bring the – in church, by the way, men and women are separated, right? So women on one side, men on the other. It's, you know, the men are the only ones that can you know, read the Bible and teach the word. So, like, there's these seven elders of the church that are, like, up on, like, what you would call, like, the pulpit area. And they're up there, and they're just, they sit, and they just sit and sit, sit until one of them stands up and delivers today's sermon, right? And it was just boring, and it was hot, and it was long. And I remember my brother and I used to sneak in Matchbox cars, you know, those little Hot Wheels cars?
Of course,
cars? Yeah. I think I had like a half a dozen of them, and we'd sneak one in our pocket. If we got caught, we were in so much trouble. And we would sneak under the pews, and we'd sit under there and just roll around our cars and think about, like, what it would be like to drive someday, you know. And I remember the elder telling my mom and my sister to stand up on one side and my dad, my brother, and I to stand up on the other. And I remember thinking, like, oh, this isn't normal church service. And you stand up, and they're like, you know, Ken and Lynn Beer have, you know, sinned against the church, and they're out. You know, we're officially excommunicated.
You got tossed out of the church?
You get excommunicated, yeah. So you're kind of, your sins are read aloud to the entire congregation, and then you're asked to leave. And this is all you've ever known your whole life are the people in this building. And you're kind of an isolated community, and you're kind of isolated from everything else. And I'll never forget the feeling of, like, walking outside. And it was like a hot summer day in Indiana. And it was summertime. We'd been playing baseball. And the doors close behind you, and it's just you and your parents, and you're just all alone. All of a sudden, in the world, everyone you know is now not supposed to have contact with you. And this is this moment of feeling just totally lost, totally scared. What just happened? Because we all think about the love of freedom, and we're going to go out into the world. And then you find yourself all of a sudden kind of without a community, and man, it gets scary fast. And about the time that panic was setting in, the doors opened up and an aunt and uncle and their kids walked out, and they had, like, voluntarily walked out. And then there was this sense of relief, like, okay, we know some people. We have a community again. And that was kind of the beginning of, like, the next chapter, which was, first things first, I got to get some dungarees. So I said, Ma, if I'm going to school this, you know, fall, I got to go get blue jeans. I got to go get, she's like, okay. So she took me to Quality Farm and Fleet in Warsaw, Indiana, which is a tractor supply store, which is the only place she knew of that sold blue jeans or denim. And there I was in the, like, spark plug aisle in, like, trying on blue jeans.
How the hell do you end up in the wine business?
So it all stems from this moment where we are told that, like, now, like, this new chapter is opening up. And education was not a thing kind of growing up. We were supposed to go to high school, and you're supposed to leave after high school and go work on the family farm. That's the plan. That's the plan for aunts and uncles and cousins. It was farm life first. And my dad never wanted to really live the farm life, and he desperately wanted us kids to go get an education. And so we were tasked with not only graduating high school and being very good students, but going to university and starting this kind of next generation movement of, like, we're all going to go to school. And so I set my sights on the big bad world university of Purdue University, West Lafayette, Indiana, go Boilers, an engineering and ag school, which might as well have been Sodom and Gomorrah as far as I knew. You know, it's like I got there and it was like, oh my, not only is it like alcohol, you know, like, you know, and tobacco, but like women's shoulders, you know, are just out on display, you know. And if I had gone to, like, Miami, I think about, like, well, my head would have exploded. If I ended up at ASU, I couldn't have figured that out.
Man, women's shoulders.
Oh, still to this day, when my wife wears, like, a spaghetti strap dress. It's just like childhood memories come flooding back, you know? And I'm like,
this is part of the reason men are just such repressed idiots.
So much so. So much so. It's awful. So I get to Purdue. I mean, you got to understand, my high school, I was like bullied. I was a kid shoved in the lockers and beaten up. And my first pair of blue jeans were bought at the tractor supply store. My mom had to cut like 30 yards of fabric out of the crotch area and re-sew them. And they were hemmed.
Don't flatter yourself.
No, out. Like, she's taking them in. She had a handful of fabric between my legs saying there's too much room in the crotch. And I remember I'm at the tractor supply store going, like, crying. Like, I don't think this is how the other kids do it, Mom. You know? But we just didn't know. And so we get thrust into this world. And then I get to Purdue, and it was just like, you know, everyone is like shots of Jack and natural ice light, you know, natural ice light beer and all this crap. And I desperately wanted to fit
it's
in.
It's called Natty Ice, by the way.
Sorry.
Natural okay. ice
right,
beer.
Right. Okay. So that shows you what a nerd I was, right? I'm going by its corporate name. So I found myself wanting desperately to fit in, but hating everything about it.
So here I am bullying you.
No, I know. That's
one of these guys.
I'll start calling you Chad Dippin. He was the great bully in high school.
Chad Dippin?
Yeah.
That's a good name.
I wonder what he's up to now.
I am him.
You are. You
no,
are,
I literally changed my name to Jason Weiss. Chad Dippin.
Yeah. Sorry, Chad. You're not listening. What am I kidding?
So you go to school for agriculture.
I went there as like aviation. I went there to be a pilot. I was going to be like a United Airlines pilot, man. That was like the height of it. Because like if driving a car was kind of like almost a sin, then I'm going to fly a goddamn plane, right?
Right, okay.
If you tell me that a woman's shoulders is bad, I'm going to start stealing Playboys.
Right.
From where can this go? You know, oh, tobacco's bad? I'm going to work in a cigar store. You know, oh, alcohol is what my grandfather called the devil's juice? Well then.
I'm going to go to Napa Valley.
Let's get into this. And so I started I was working at a cigar store in West Lafayette, Indiana called Bogey's Stogies. And I was the cigar buyer. And this was in like the early 90s. So like this is like 94, 95. Like this is when cigars were booming. And I was the cigar buyer. And, you know, I would read Cigar Aficionado and talk cigars with all the guys that came in. And at one point I was regaling one of them with like this Connecticut Shade wrapper, you know, it's grown in the Dominican and it's so different than their Maduro from Nicaragua. And the guy's like, oh man, you really seem to be into the location of where the tobacco comes from. I said, well, don't you think that's fascinating? And the guy goes, yeah, but if you think that's fascinating, you should check out wine. It's like even 30 times more. And so my head cocked to the side and I said, huh. I reached down. We had Wine Spectator in the rack next to Cigar Aficionado, and I just started reading it. And I got fascinated by it. I was such a nerd. I was checking out books from the library on wine. You know, I'm reading wine books from the library. That's a nerd for you.
Well, that's not that nerdy.
It's great. And then it's nerdy. But it was great. I learned, and then I used my fake ID to start buying wine from like the jug shop in West Lafayette. I would walk in, there's like kegs stacked everywhere, and I'd be like, huh? Show me to your wine section, my good man. And the guy's like, we have 3 bottles and it's all Australian and it's dusty. And I was like, well, I'll take those. And I tried to learn wine through that and then started driving to Chicago to pick up cigars. And then we went to a place called Knightsbridge Wine Shop. And the cover of Wine Spectator was Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. I think it was September of 1996. Stag's Leap Wine Cellars was on the cover of Wine Spectator. And I was like, so do you have this wine? And the guy's like, yeah, we don't have that one because, you know, it's on the cover of Wine Spectator and everybody wants it. But, you know, that's called Cask 23. They also make 2 other wines, Fay and SLV. And we've got the Fay Vineyard Cab. Would you like that? And I was like, I certainly would. It's $54. Do you take Shell gas card? You know, I had to split it up between credit cards and change from the car. And I took that, drove from Naperville, Illinois, back to West Lafayette with that bottle strapped into the passenger seat, seat belted in. My grandfather would let me take steaks from the freezer. He raised cattle that we would butcher, and I could take some steaks when I was home for my emergency rations at college. I cooked a steak, I baked a potato. I opened that bottle of 1992 Stag's Leap Wine Cellars Fay Vineyard Cabernet, and it was like, it's like a movie where everything's in black and white and then someone just turned on the color. Like, everything changed for me. Everything changed for me. Like, all of a sudden, you know, music was better, food tasted better, colors were brighter. It was like I had found that missing thing in my life that needed to plug in. Like there was that last puzzle piece to kind of fit into place in this new adventurous life I was trying to lead away from Milford, Indiana. And that was it. That changed the course of the rest of my life. And then when I bailed on the idea of law school and told my parents that instead of being the fancy lawyer that they always wanted in the family, I was going to move to California. I was going to move to San Francisco with my friend Darren, and we were going to buy a sailboat together that we were going to live on, and I was going to get in the wine business. And my mom starts crying, and my dad's like, it's not that bad. And my mom's like, didn't you hear our son? He's some sort of drunken sailor and probably gay. And I was like, whoa, Darren's just a friend. Calm down, Mom, you know? So I gotta talk her off a ledge. But I just gave myself, I said, you've got 6 months to figure it out and move to Napa. And I saved every penny. And I loaded my car, 1990 Chevy Beretta with peeling paint. And I'd never been west of Illinois, you know, like it's like this was like the first kind of movement west. And I just drove out here and I went to Stag's Leap Wine Cellars just up the road and I knocked on the door and I asked to see the manager. Her name was Gabrielle. And I told her this story and I think I even got emotional about it. And I said, so I'll do anything. I'll sweep the floors. I'll clean the windows. I'll clean the toilets. Just tell me what I can do to be a part of Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. And she said, we're not hiring. And she closed the door. And I was like, holy shit, I saw that going totally different in my head. Like, you know, like I had 2 weeks of a drive cross country where in my mind that was going to go very differently. And I went back to my car and I just like, fuck, what did I do? And so I went back up and I knocked on the door again. And this kid named Aaron Trisniewski was like, dude, what's up? I was like, can I talk to her again? And he's like, I'll go ask her. And he comes out of the office and goes, she won't talk to you again. And he goes, do you just want to do a tasting? I was like, I kind of do. And he goes, it's $5. And I was like, I don't know if I can afford that. And he's like, all right, I'll give you a free tasting. So I tell this guy my whole story, some kid working behind the tasting bar. And he goes, you know what? I was going to tell Gabrielle next week that I want to go to part-time. I'm going to go tell her right now. And maybe you can get a couple days out of my shift. And Gabrielle comes back out and she's like, okay, so you're back again. You've convinced one of my employees to give up half their shift so you can work here. And I said, no, I promise, ma'am, I didn't ask. She goes, that's okay. Come back tomorrow, you'll interview with me and one other person and we'll see if you're right for the job. So I went home, I memorized every Stag's Leap Wine Cellar's review from Wine Spectator on their wines in case I was given a tasting. I could regurgitate the right words to go with everything. And I was interviewing to literally like clean and like wash glasses. And I put on like my khakis and a button-down shirt and a tie. And I showed up 20 minutes early and yes ma'ams and no ma'ams. And they offered me the job working Saturdays to wash the glasses in the tasting room. $2.75 an hour to wash glasses in the tasting room. And I was the happiest. Oh man, it was the best. I couldn't believe it. Went home, they let me take home the little bits of the bottles, you know, that were open from the day. I went back to my sailboat in Alameda and I told Darren the good news that I had gotten a job at Stag's Leap. And we celebrated with hot dogs and the leftover bits of bottles of wine that I had taken from Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. And that was it, man. I have never looked back.
Are you still dating Darren?
Darren and I, we both decided we were better off just friends. he's got kids now. What a faker!
And you're married to a woman.
I'm married to uncomfortable. Yeah. No, we both have our beards. It's fine. Yeah.
That's insanity. Yeah. That's the kind of thing you just. That's why I wanted you to tell that story, Nadine. I'm sorry for the profanity and the bad things in there to our producer, Nadine.
You can't tell a story like that without throwing it.
That's why you need the hard hitting stuff. Then to come back and find out this guy's a Mennonite still on Rumspringer.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you understand. You understand where he's coming from. Well, it is a pleasure to talk with you, even though you're an alien who says natural light.
Yes,
natural right. Ice instead of Daddy
natural
Ice.
It's like LLC beer. Yeah, you can see I still struggle to fit in. I'm still just the guy trying to make sure no one understands that my mom made my dungarees at home. You know, Like, it's my constant. And, you know, I throw myself then headlong into everything. It's like, okay, cars, fashion, alcohol, and just never repent for it.
The thing is, like, now after we've drank two glasses of wine doing this, you have to go do a blind tasting session that goes up next week on Sound
TV. Yeah, which I will go 0-4, which will be great. But I can't wait. I remain unapologetic for the scarf I'm going to wear in the video. And my grandfather's dying words, this is no joke, Grandpa Maurice Beer's last words is like we're sitting there bedside is, "You're a disappointment." And I'm like, "Just go to the light, Grandpa. Just go to the light. It's fine.
Go to the
light. Go to the light.
I'll be below looking up at you when I die."
Exactly. I was like, "I know you don't mean it. You just don't know." I mean, there's a guy that had left Kosciuszko County twice, and everything was just, you know, about this kind of very cloistered world. And, you know.
Well, you know, in some ways, Napa's not that different.
It's totally not. It's totally not. And you find yourself kind of like, I don't know. I fall in love with agriculture all over again. You know, as a kid, I swore it off, right? You know, working in the soybean, hoeing rogue weeds out of the soybean fields was one of my jobs. So to take a hoe and walk every row and hoe out the weeds and the rogue corn that would grow so it didn't interfere with Grandpa's seed, or to, you know, slopping the hogs, or, you know, castrating hogs. There's a job you never want to do again.
Jesus, Jones. Next podcast.
Next podcast.
Listen, Jonah, I love you, man. We got to go and do this blind tasting sessions, but... behave yourself.
I don't know if I can, but we'll try.
Love it.
All right. This is great. Thanks, Jason, for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
If you made it this far.
If you made it this far, we have dropped our prices, $5.99 a month, $49.99 a year for SOM TV. We are launching our entire podcast network, of which I might have to make Jonah do one. That is launching very, very, very soon. History of Wine, Reading and Drinking, A Glass for Every Palate, Weekly Cocktail with Sabato Zagaria. All of those are either up right now or will be up soon to take a listen to the trailer and subscribe. All of you, please be safe. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.